I'm very excited that you've brought your opera, Mrs. President, here to Rochester for a performance this weekend. It's the story of this American historical woman, Victoria Woodhull, who ran for president, that even here in the town where Susan B. Anthony and Seneca Falls are just part of our daily experience, isn't as well known. What drew you to this story?
Well, Victoria Woodhull is such a fascinating person, and most people don't know much about her, which I find to be something I'd like to change. The reason I heard about her first, which was decades ago, was my mother was traveling and she stayed at a hotel in San Francisco, and there was a plaque on the wall that said, Victoria Woodhull, first woman to run for president, slept here. So she was interested and dug a little deeper and found out more about her and said to me, you know, this might make a good subject for an opera. And at the moment I was involved with writing another opera, so I sort of tucked it in my back pocket. And several years later, a number of excellent biographies of not only Victoria Woodhull, but the whole time in which she lived came out. And so a lot of that background research had already been done, which was very, very helpful. And then I was introduced to Hilary Bell, who is the librettist on Mrs. President. And she was studying at Juilliard with Marsha Norman, who was the Pulitzer Prize winning author who wrote Night Mother. And Marsha said, you know, I've got this student who is independently interested in Victoria Woodhull. I think the two of you should meet. And so we met, and it was, the chemistry was perfect, the electricity was there. And so then we started working on how do we take this huge, messy life story and coalesce it into a simple through line so that you can say in one sentence, basically, what is this opera about? And Hilary was absolutely brilliant in terms of being able to combine characters and to give the whole story a narrow focus. And really what we are focused on is the year 1872, when Victoria Woodhull ran for president against Ulysses S. Grant in his second term. And her running mate was Frederick Douglass. So, I mean, can you imagine in 1872 how far ahead of the curve she was?
And people didn't want to accept this at the time. She was, actually, that's, you know, we talk a lot now, it seems, when there's a case, you know, we need to have the perfect representative, or even you need the perfect victim if it's going to, if a story's going to resonate. Victoria Woodhull had a messy, complicated life as a strong woman, but not, you know, a simple saint for everyone to look up to.
Definitely not a saintly person. And for that reason, the suffrage movement first embraced her because, number one, she was an eloquent spokesperson and very passionate about the subject of women's freedom to vote, and even addressed a joint session of Congress in which she said, I am a citizen. I pay taxes. Therefore, as a citizen, I already have the right to vote. And they had to mull that over and finally decided, of course, that it was going to be a state-by-state decision. And New York, in its wisdom, was the first in 1919, to grant women the vote. And so she was, at first, a perfect spokesman for the suffrage movement. But then she moved beyond only advocating women's right to vote, and advocated free love, which you can imagine would be probably as controversial today if a politician embraced that as it was then. But I do need a backup and say what she meant by free love. It wasn't a kind of return to the 60s love-in hippie movement. It was the fact that women really had no freedom. If they were in an abusive relationship, and they wanted to divorce their husbands, they could get a divorce, but they had no right to their children. They had no right to their property. They were a pariah in society. And so basically, for all intents and purposes, they were chained to a relationship that where love was no longer a part of it. And so her two words, free love, really meant that you have the freedom to love anyone you want and to get out of that relationship when love is no longer a part of it. And I think that's something that we're still wrestling with today. I think there are still a lot of women who are trapped in loveless relationships. And this was too much, I think, for the suffrage movement. And because it was such a controversial phrase, and because she was, as you say, no saint. I mean, she was not above blackmailing Henry Ward Beecher to endorse her campaign. They dropped her. And so we have the names of the famous suffragists, such as Susan B. Anthony. But Victoria Woodhull has been sort of relegated maybe to a footnote in American history.
And she ran a newspaper. She was a stockbroker.
She was the first woman to have a seat on the New York Stock Exchange, yes. She had a newspaper, Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly. She came from a background of no money and no education. And that is one of the things that I find so fascinating about her. She was so motivated and so driven that she came from Homer, Ohio, a tiny little town where she had been kind of carted around by her parents as a child medium. And she did feel a connection with the spiritual world, but for her it was real, and this was just a fake show. So she, and she was married off early to a doctor who turned out to be an alcoholic and a womanizer, so she knew what being trapped in an abusive relationship was like. So she picked herself up. She moved to New York with her sister, Tennessee Claflin. I'm not making this up. And they met Cornelius Vanderbilt, who used to consult spiritualists to make his stock reports. And I mean, we can go back as recently as Nancy Reagan, who was very much involved with consulting spiritualists. So this is not the most far-fetched idea. One of the things that I find the most interesting is that she was able to meet Cornelius Vanderbilt, because you can imagine if somebody wanted to meet Bill Gates today, you know, there would be walls and walls and walls of protection around him. But she was able to meet him. He was enchanted with both of them, particularly with her sister, Tennessee, and decided to just kind of as a lark give them the opportunity to work on Wall Street, to have a seat. And they were sort of a joke in the industry at first. There was a cartoon of the bewitching sisters standing in a cart, all dressed in very frilly clothes. And pulling the cart are cartoons of bears and bulls with faces of prominent New York politicians and stockbrokers. And some of them are caught under the wheels of this coach. And Victoria has a whip in her hand. And it's all very amusing and ho, ho, ho. But the joke, they had the last word, because she made a fortune on Wall Street, which was gave her the ability to buy a big mansion in Manhattan and invite her whole family and her ex-husband, because she remarried, because her ex-husband, as I say, was an alcoholic and couldn't really take care of himself. So she, in the magnanimous ability of her newly found fortune, was able to invite everybody to come and live with her. And she was quite a wild woman.
And those depictions of her on Wall Street just reminds me of the compromises women have made in so many different things, or, you know, the decisions you make, like being in the all-girl orchestra, but it's also getting you a chance to be a professional musician at the time that it wasn't as regarded.
Exactly.
So I'm just also fascinated with her as a character. Then if I think about opera, or even in life, she has so many things that we accept in male characters in operas, that they get to do these things and not have it be their undoing, whether it's having younger lovers, having older lovers, you know, defying society, fighting the overall, you know, dominant culture to do what they want to do. So what was it like writing? Perhaps we can talk a little bit about her as a character in the libretto, but for you, writing music for this character?
Excellent question. Well, so many women in opera are victims, and you can really count pretty much on the fingers of one or maybe two hands those opera characters who are not. I think of Well, Carmen is one that springs to mind, even though in the end she does become a victim in the end. But she's a bad girl, and she's the heroine of Carmen. And I just always have loved her character because of her strength and because of the freedom that she says. She is not owned by any man. She is really one of the first free lovers in opera. And so I wanted to create something, a music for Victoria Woodhull that had that kind of strength of character. And the interesting thing about creating characters in opera is that they're not static. You may draw a profile of somebody musically where you first meet them, but then their interaction with other characters, it's as though those other characters' music seeps in and influences their own music. So, for example, the character of Henry Ward Beecher, who ends up being her nemesis, when we first meet him, we think he's a really good guy. He delivers a beautiful sermon to a congregation that has just witnessed and been through the Civil War. They've lost sons, fathers, maybe even daughters. I mean, it's been the most tragic upheaval in American history to that point. And he delivers a beautiful sermon on that. And at the end of the sermon, a young black girl who has escaped from her slave owner and is about to be recaptured by him, Henry Ward Beecher, who of course has a background in as an abolitionist, and his sister Harriet Beecher Stowe and Uncle Tom's Cabin was very well known. So Henry Ward Beecher encourages his congregation to buy her freedom from the slave owner. But the way he does it as a kind of a mock auction. He says, look at this young girl. She's strong. She has good teeth. She has good bones. What would you pay for her? Would you like to see this woman this young girl, she's not really a woman yet, this young girl who could be your daughter, would you like to see her be owned by this slave owner? And the congregation is shocked, and they say, no, of course not. He said, well, then, you know, bid on her. And so he holds an auction. And it's sort of, as I say, like a mock auction, as though she's on the slave block, but she's not. He's about to buy her freedom. And so we like him as a character in the beginning. And it's only as the plot develops that we see his character, the sort of the underbelly, the dark underbelly of his character. And with Victoria Woodhull, in the like manner, we see her first in the first scene where she looks back on herself as a child and says, you know, I had a miserable childhood, but the spirits, and I had to sort of pretend that I was reading people's fortunes. And the trauma of that for me was that the spirits were real. And yet here I was having to sort of fake what was real to me. And so that's the first time we meet her. And so we see that she's a very sincere person. And all the musical themes that we hear in that first scene all follow her throughout the opera.
I was very struck by a lush and romantic sense when listening to it, but also especially as she's doing difficult things and confronting people who can undo her life, there's a sense of unease.
Well, you know what's interesting, and I'm one of the reasons why I'm so happy to be a composer in today's day and age, is that we have a large musical palette that is available to us. I mean, there was a time when if you didn't write 12-tone music, you were laughed out of the musical canon. And yet there were some composers, I give you Leonard Bernstein, who continued to write in a tonal manner and was kind of poo-pooed for that reason. Today, I think writing tonal music, writing chromatic music, writing music that has a minimalist profile, all of that is acceptable. So what it's done is it's given us this much wider palette because basically, for me, in terms of writing dramatic music, you want to be able to have something that expresses so many subtle levels of emotion. And my background in writing for opera was actually when I had just graduated from the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. I had the ability to work for a number of film composers as ghostwriter and as orchestrator. And the way a film score works with a film has a lot of similarities to the way an orchestra and an opera composer works with an opera. All of the elements of drama are there, the elements of having to, in a way, stay out of the dialogue, out of the way of the dialogue, so the dialogue can be understood. And when you're writing opera, you want the voice to be heard. You don't want to be smothering it. So all of those things are very, very similar. Setting the scene for an action, giving the subtext, which a lot of film scores do when you're seeing action, and yet you're hearing something that is very contrasting to what you're actually seeing.
And that's good. You talk a little bit more about the experience of working in Hollywood as a young composer.
Yes, it was really fascinating. I had the good fortune to work for two really extraordinary film composers. One, a real old-timer by the name of Hugo Friedhofer. And if any of your listeners know their film score composers, I'm sure they will be familiar with The Best Years of Our Lives and other iconic film scores that Hugo Friedhofer wrote. And he was a very elderly man at the time that I met him, but he was still working. He was doing mostly television at that point. And he was funny and brilliant and so incredibly experienced. I learned a great deal from him. And then the other composer I worked for was Paul Glass, no relationship to Philip Glass, who had done a number of major films, one of them Otto Preminger, Bunny Lake is Missing, and worked at that time. He was working for Metromedia and doing the undersea world of Jacques Cousteau. And I got to write a lot of fish music for that, which was great fun. So, you know, it was absorbing these people's experience that really helped me. And I'll tell you one other thing about film score composers, and that is they understand deadlines. You know, if you have to stay up all night and get the music finished so that the copyist can pick it up in the morning and then it'll be recorded that afternoon, they understand that. They also very often have to farm out a lot of music because, film score is generally the last thing that gets done on a film when all the editing is done. And so working on a deadline like that and taking it very seriously was also an excellent lesson to learn.
And as you're working on this opera about Victoria Woodhull, facing all these challenges and overcoming some, but finding, you know, all the challenges in the system, did it evoke anything of your journey in music as a composer and a conductor, which is still, unfortunately, challenging for women in ways that it isn't always for men?
One of the reasons why I wanted to write this opera was because I wanted to spend time with this very inspiring woman who was called Mrs. Satan. I kid you not, there was an article in Harper's Weekly that portrayed her as a demon with horns on her head and black wings, and she was going to be the ruination of society. And if we think that women have a hard time today, which we do, it was even harder for her then. And to really know more about her and how she did not, she would not be squelched by this, and she did not accept the obstacles that were constantly put in her way. This was so inspiring to me. And my favorite scene in the opera is at the very end where she is jailed. And by the way, we did a workshop performance. Actually, it was just scenes. It wasn't really a workshop. It was scenes from the opera before the election last year. When Hillary Clinton, of course, was running for president. And, of course, we had seen on TV and radio where the crowd would yell, "Lock her up, lock her up." So there's a scene towards the end of the opera where the crowd is heckling Victoria Woodhull and they say, "Scandals, scandals." And I added the words, "Lock her up." And the audience went, "Oh." It was just so close. And what is even closer is the fact that she was locked up, that she did spend election night in jail, and I'm not making this up. And so my favorite scene in the opera, because this really shows the grit that was at her core. She is in jail. Her husband has left her. Her closest friends have abandoned her. Her financial empire is in complete ruins. She is at the nadir of her life. And what would happen with most people? They would probably just implode. But no, at a certain point where she realizes that her ideas are good, her vision is good, what she sees in the future is right. And she says, arise, arise from my ashes, arise. And in the background, we hear the chorus starting to say the words, arise, arise. And the production that we did in Anchorage, Alaska, which was a semi-staged production, there are a lot of prominent women politicians in Alaska, and they were part of this final scene. So when she says this, they walked out of the wings onto the stage, down the stage, and through the aisles. And everybody in the audience knew them because these were prominent politicians. And it was thrilling. It was one of those goosebump moments that you just never, never forget. And I kind of hope that in every city where this is performed, we can have something similar where the living legacy of what Victoria Woodhull was envisioning that she couldn't get to herself, but she felt other people would, where that living legacy is here now.
Our mayor in Rochester is a woman, and so is our county executive, and actually we're represented by Louise Slaughter and, oh, Kristen Gillibrand is. So we're pretty, yeah, you have those figures here in New York.
And well, I hope they will be there.
So, and that's to bring it to talk about our production here in Rochester. I mean, it's amazing that it's coming to Rochester. What with our legacy with Seneca Falls in the region, Susan B. Anthony in her home, and actually the spiritualist connection too. This is the area of the Fox sisters, and a lot of that side of American history plays in here. But I think the more important one is probably the legacy of women's suffrage and all that. So tell us about how the production is coming together here at the Lyric Opera Theater.
The production is coming together so beautifully. I am really thrilled. We have a stunning cast, and we have a wonderful director. Lindsay Baker is our director, and as I said to her yesterday, since the opera had never really been fully staged, she is bringing so much to the table, her ideas about staging this, that it's like opening up another door for me that we haven't had. And all of the other productions have either been concert performances or semi-staged, and this is really being staged in quite a lot of detail. And the performance space, the Lyric Theater where we're performing, lends itself so beautifully to this particular story, because it was a church, a Christian Science church, and so when Henry Ward Beecher is giving his sermon, we have a church right there. It's, I guess, almost like a meeting hall as well. So when Victoria Woodhull is giving her speech in Steinway Hall, we also have a perfect setup. So things are really working out well. Valerie Bernhardt, who was our Victoria Woodhull in all of the previous productions, and Scott Ramsey, who was Henry Ward Beecher in all previous productions, are both the two principals of the cast, and we have a wonderful, wonderful group of singers. I think many of them are graduates of the Eastman School. I'm quite thrilled with our cast and our wonderful pianist, Orlando Diaz.
As you put it together and stage it, as it came together, were there surprises or things that you thought, that story has to be in there, but no, we have to let it go? How was the story shaped as it became an opera?
Well, it's interesting. We created a storyboard. Hilary Bell, the librettist, and I created a storyboard, and I did it in index cards so that we could move them around, which was really interesting because I had a very strong idea of which scenes I wanted to musicalize. So, you know, does this scene go in Act 1? Does it go in Act 2? Is there a corollary scene? So the shape of it really was something that was very, very fluid in the beginning. And we've had a number of workshops, and those workshops also influenced how we felt the dramatic action should happen. Because the significant thing with opera is not only the music. You can have wonderful music. And, you know, in music history, we have fabulous genius composers like Haydn and Schubert who wrote operas. But the librettos were not necessarily good enough and the drama was not strong enough that they have really survived other than as curiosities. Of course, a composer like Mozart had a brilliant librettist in Da Ponte, and his operas work as theater, as music, on every level. But the drama is really important. And do you need to cut out a scene? I'm kind of jealous of the way music theater gestates, because composers and book writers and lyricists is usually a triumvirate for music theater, have a long gestation period. They have many workshops. They have a lot of previews, out-of-town previews before, you know, it hits the big time. And I think that gestation period is extremely important for any theatrical work. And I'm happy to say that we have had a number of workshops before it ever really got into its finished form. And as a matter of fact, because of the fully staged performance now, it's still evolving in terms of, do we need what is called a safety? Now, safety is one of the most important words in theater. It means this can be repeated. And so, you know, if the performers have to get from point A to point B on the stage and you only have a short amount of music, a safety can mean that short amount of music can be repeated until they make it to the stage or make it off the stage. And so we're still evolving those things. And I think I learned a lot from the music theater people that I worked with. In particular, Jonathan Tunick, who is a brilliant composer and musician, clarinetist, and is also the orchestrator that has orchestrated all of the Stephen Sondheim shows. And I consulted with him throughout the working process of Mrs. President, and he was so helpful. His advice, his practical advice, as well as his musical advice was so important. So I think that in terms of, you know, is it finished? Well, you know, it's always a work in progress. And I said to Lindsay yesterday that she is coming up with things that I didn't think of. So the collaborative process, which I'm so used to having with singers, now with the director, is also something that I find very, very stimulating.
And if we haven't mentioned it before, we should also mention that you are conducting this performance as well.
Yes, I am. Yes, I'm.
So how is it looking from that side now?
Oh, fine. You know, I'm used to conducting my own work, so that's a given. I mean, I know my own tempos. In a certain respect, it's always interesting for me when somebody else conducts my music, because then I find out the things that I just do intuitively might not be so intuitive to somebody else. And I have to be more specific about notating certain things in the score that, you know, if I'm conducting it, I know exactly what to do. I don't have to have this argument with myself or discussion.
That's perhaps we could talk a little bit about the rest of your musical life. You're based in New York City, but you travel a lot. Talk a bit about Juilliard and your other projects right now.
Yes, I'm a graduate of Juilliard. I have both my master's and my doctorate, and that was in conducting. I wanted to have a double major, but they didn't have double majors. I don't know if they do to this day. So I had to, I was accepted in composition, and I had to make a decision. Was I going to stay in composition, or was I going to switch my major to conducting, which I did because it gave me a lot of experience with the orchestra. And then what happened when I graduated from Juilliard was my first job was as a conductor with the Pittsburgh Symphony, which was, you know, pretty big job. And then my conducting career took off. So the horse and the cart got reversed there for a while. And in 1995, as music director of the Roanoke Symphony and artistic director of Opera Roanoke, and my time was like 99.9% spent conducting, and I had all of these composition projects that I wanted to complete, particularly opera, and I knew I needed time. I made the very, very difficult decision to switch the priorities, to have composition first and conducting second. I still do a lot of conducting. After I finish this production, I'm going to Chicago to conduct Giancarlo Menotti's Amahl and the Night Visitors with Chamber Opera Chicago, and my own Hanukkah opera, which is going to be paired as a double bill. And so I still do a fair amount of conducting, but not nearly as much. I was on an airplane every week in the past.
And was opera the primary thing that drew you into composing, or is that something that's evolved over time?
Well, actually, yes. Even though I've written chamber music and symphonic music and other musical forms. But my father sang with the New York City Opera. And so when I was 7 years old, I was in the children's chorus of the New York City Opera, got my social security number, got to wear a costume and makeup. It was so much fun. And of course, I learned all of my father. My father was a bass, and he sang Osmin and Leporello, and he sang all of the comic bass roles and some that were not so comic, like Sparafucile and Rigoletto. And so I got very familiar with the operatic repertory from hearing him sing, and he was such a brilliant performer, and then being in the children's chorus. So, you know, opera drew me in immediately.
And it is such a challenging thing to get opera to stage because there are so many parts. You know, you can write a string quartet and probably find four people who want to play it for you, hopefully. But where next for Mrs. President after Rochester?
Oh, from your mouth to God's ear. Yes, I'm hoping that we will have many, many more productions after this one.
And is there anything else you want to add about the production or performance this weekend or about?
I would just would like to say that we have such a brilliant cast. It's been very gratifying for me coming and meeting these singers who have taken the roles that they are performing and made it their own. You know, it's wonderful when you're working with artists, with people who have their own ideas about the characters and who understand the characters and bring their own personal nuance to it. In addition to beautiful voices, I think we have stunning actors. And the chorus is wonderful, the beautiful voices. And I have to thank Sue Contraneo for putting together such a wonderful cast and for having the courage to present Mrs. President.
And before I guess I let you go, maybe if we do have time to talk about, is there any one scene where you sort of want to unpack musically what happens between the characters?
One of the crucial scenes in the opera, it comes at the end of Act One, and it's called Predators. And it is the first meeting, confrontation between Henry Ward Beecher and Victoria Woodhull. The scene takes place in her newspaper office, which she has just started. She has been conducting a séance prior to that, and she tells all of the people at the séance, these offices are going to be now converted to Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly, and we're going to take on corruption. And, you know, so she's really gung-ho about this newspaper. And one of her ardent followers is Henry Ward Beecher's younger sister, Isabella. And Isabella is smitten with Victoria Woodhull as a person, because she has been raised to be a proper young lady and to basically hew the line of, you know, be a mother and not ruffle society. Mm-hmm. And here she sees this wild woman, and she is just amazed and wants to, you know, see another lifestyle, wants to be that lifestyle. And her brother, Henry Ward Beecher, her older brother, is completely aghast at this. And so he's angry with Victoria Woodhull for that. But even worse than that, he has found out that she knows about his many affairs with his female parishioners and has been perhaps letting other people in the community know about that. So he comes storming into her newspaper office, ready to crush her, because he is used to being, he's a powerful man, and he is used to taking on women and not being challenged by them. So he thinks, this is going to be an easy situation. I will just storm in her, bully her, and stop this business right away. And what he comes crashing into is she thinks it's funny. She thinks it's humorous. She's not intimidated by him. She doesn't try and fight fire with fire. She just thinks he's silly. And that makes him even angrier. And he says, I will crush you. I will kill you. And she says, well, you know, I have a story about you, and it's ready to print. And she shows him the potential headline of his affairs. And all of a sudden, he realizes this woman has the power to ruin my career. And so he goes from being a bully to groveling. And he says, what do you want of me? And must I confess? And she says, no, you don't have to confess. Just endorse my campaign. She said, you are a free lover. I know that you have a loveless marriage with your wife, and you're a passionate man, and you are seeking love wherever you can find it. So it's not that I'm condemning you for what you do. I'm condemning you for being a hypocrite, for saying one thing and doing another. So basically, come out of the closet and admit that you are a free lover and endorse my campaign. And he is so taken aback by this because he's basically ashamed of what he does because he considers himself a man of God. And this is a weakness of his that he can't control. Of course, we don't know anybody like that in our current political
scene. Oh,
there's
so much to unpack here. Yeah, the powerful man who doesn't want to be ridiculous, who makes people hide things. But then she's not necessarily doing what we're asking of people now, which is to come out and make it clean. She's using this.
That's right. And so he thinks, wow, there's somebody that doesn't think I'm doing the wrong thing. I don't have to hide who I really am. And he says, well, I was born too late. I'm really like a satyr, like something out of, Greek mythology, chasing the nymphs. And so all of a sudden, their whole relationship changes, and they are very attracted to each other, which is why it's called predators. He's a predatory person, but so is she. She will do almost anything to get what she wants. And it's not so much for her own personal power, but it's to be able to have a platform for what she believes is equality. So, she has this great vision, but she's not unwilling to do some unsavory things in order to get there, which is why she's not a saint and why she's interesting as an operatic character. So in that scene, at the end of that scene, they are basically tearing each other's clothes off, which I don't know how much Lindsay is going to do with that, but the idea is that the two of them are just completely drawn to each other. Of course, in the beginning of Act Two, when he is had a chance to catch his breath, and then the cold, clear light of morning, he says, what? Am I crazy? How can I endorse this woman? She's going to ruin me. It's her fault. She seduced me. She is colluding with the Russians.
Mm.
That's not really part of it, but
this is where all the musical text and subtext come together to probably depict these changing relationships of these characters.
Exactly.
So, Victoria Bond, thank you so much for talking with me about this opera.
What a pleasure to be here. Thank you.